Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Avi Stamen, co-host of the Scholarly Communication podcast. When I'm not podcasting, I dedicate my time to my family, biking out in the mountains, and running my company, Academic Language Experts, an author services company dedicated to helping scholars elevate their research prior to publication and grant proposals to receive research funding. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Sally Wilson, Vice President of Publishing at Emerald Publishing. Sally is an experienced publishing professional responsible for the strategic development of Emerald's global publishing program, which comprises of journals, books, and teaching cases with a commitment to real-world impact, a focus on research aligned to the UN SDGs, innovation through non-traditional content types, and author experience. Sally represents Emerald on the Working Group of Joint Commitment for Action on Inclusion and Diversity in Publishing and the SDG Publisher Compact Fellows. Outside of work, Sally enjoys cooking and entertaining family and friends and going to the theater and cinema. Sally, thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure having you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Thank you for taking the time. And I'm glad that you added the more personal part to your bio, because for some reason, other folks don't seem to do that. And I think it's nice to give you a little bit of a window into who you are beyond your work attire. Maybe you could take me back a minute and just tell me a little bit about if there was a moment or a period in time earlier in your career where you kind of realized that academic publishing was going to be your calling, or that you fell in love with academic publishing.
Well, to my detriment, I fell in love with scholarly publishing, academic publishing, quite late, to be honest. So I had about a 25-year career, primarily at Wolters Kluwer, but I wasn't in their academic publishing division, but a variety of business-to-business publishing roles, from sort of production, editorial, product, and publishing, of course, and commercial roles. And I joined Emerald in 2019. And what attracted me to both Emerald and academic publishing is just that belief that our actions as a publisher can help make a real world difference, and not only in academia, but beyond academia. So, to my detriment, I'm full of regrets that I didn't enter academic publishing earlier, definitely.
Can you, I'm curious if you could just expand upon that for a minute about the impact, approach. And I know that that's sort of a word that maybe has been used a lot. Definitely, I know in the grant, side of things, there's a whole impact section of most grants that are written. But maybe you could tell us in a very practical, pragmatic way, how that could impact the way that a publisher approaches its work, such as Emerald.
Yeah, I think often when we think about impact, we think as the publication as the impact for the research. And it's so much more than that. It's actually that real world application where you can actually see it making a difference to society and the people within our society. So what we've been trying to do is have conversations at Emerald with researchers before they've even thought about publication, when they're starting that research. Just sort of a check-in, how's it going? What are you working on? And then hopefully, you know, not being naive, when they're time to publish, they might remember that conversation with us at Emerald. And then we can support them with the publication, of course, but also thinking about how we can support them elevating their author platform and getting their research beyond the paywall, beyond academia, through novel content types. So, you know, through podcasts, through blog posts, through using social media effectively.
I love that approach of kind of, you know, catching those really interesting research projects early on in the process. I actually made this argument in an article I recently published in Scholarly Kitchen that, you know, in the books realm, you know, acquisitions editors, a big part of their job is having these engaging conversations early on in the process to kind of help the authors think through their ideas and come up with something which is really going to be meaningful and impactful, not only for, you know, those 5, 10, 15, 20 readers that, you know, subscribe to the journal, but well beyond. And so I really love that idea of extending that to the journal world, whereby where don't only become interested once you've got all your results and once you've kind of, once everything's already done, essentially, but rather having some sort of impact on the direction or, you know, kind of strategic priorities of what are some of the topics that we want to be exploring.
Yeah. And we created a new role at Emerald about 2 years ago now called the Publishing Development Manager role. And they work with their networks and try and go beyond their existing networks to reach out to new researchers. So they look at what's being done by institutions. It's through the lens of the UN SDGs, and they each have a sort of an area of focus. So healthier lives, quality education, responsible management, and a fairer society. And they're looking at the research that's being done in those institutions and the people who are aligned to the SDGs that they sort of, they caretake for Emerald. So they're trying to build that network beyond just having conversations, as I say, at publication, but really trying to understand those institutions that align to the UN SDGs and the work that they're doing.
So I'm going off script here, so please stop me if I'm but I have to, I'm really curious about this. There was, without going into detail, we got ourselves into a bit of hot water a few months back. We ran a panel, a live panel on how publishers can impact publishing strategy and agenda with a leading medical publisher. And we didn't think twice about it when we put out the promo and the advertising for it. And then we got a lot of flack on Twitter from scholars who came along and said, well, who are you to dictate an agenda of, you know, as the publisher to dictate an agenda or what we should be researching? Your job is purely to take what we deem to be important and get it out there. So I wonder if you've come across any pushback in terms of setting some strategic priorities and kind of where you see that line and the balance between, you know, letting the researchers come with the innovative ideas, but also saying, well, here are things that Emerald finds to be important and value and wants to publish about.
Yeah, we haven't had a lot of pushback. I think it's, it's a two-way conversation. It's we're trying to be a facilitator or having those collaborative relationships. So when we're thinking about themes, we look at, where research is happening. We look at where funding is happening. And then we try and connect the dots. But it's very much a two-way conversation. We're not looking to dictate, but we're looking to probe, ask provocative questions, and then see how the research lines up. So, we might have a provocative question such as should billionaires exist? And then we'll look at what research is happening that might, continue the debate. And it's a way of curating existing content that we have, as well as signposting new research or just new thought leadership pieces, blog posts, just to stimulate that conversation. And as I say, it's usually through the lens of the UN SDGs. And so you might think about it, linked to SDG 2, no poverty. So it's just trying to sort of theme where research is happening and just trying to bring it to that wider audience.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it does a lot of good. I mean, A is being, you know, not deciding on your own, but rather taking on some of these bigger challenges and tackling those. So it's not like, you know, you can just, it's not a commercial argument. Rather, it really is related back to greater priorities, which, you know, society has deemed to be important. I think is important. And I also think it's important to kind of define who you are so that potential authors know that they're coming to the right place, right? Because if you know, authors, I don't know that if the first thought they have is, well, which publisher am I going to publish in? But I guess the more you're aligned with certain ideas or concepts or frameworks, the more authors say, oh, I've got something, you know, it's going to be a natural step to consider Emerald.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's around almost sort of, you know, positioning yourself in the market for the things that we're passionate about. But we hope also, you know, those in the social sciences and applied sciences communities are also looking at, thinking about, doing research into. So it's about leading and responding. But it's really about having that two-way dialogue.
Yeah. So tell us just a little bit about the different hats I'm sure that you wear as the VP of publishing at Emerald. What exactly does that mean? What does your day look like? And kind of how do you see your role when you reflect back on it?
It's a really hands-on role. And it is a lot of, there's no typical day. It's a really good mix of strategic and operational, which I really love. And I get to work closely with researchers as well as colleagues in sort of various functions across the business. So, you know, product, production, editorial, sales and marketing. And it's also an opportunity to collaborate with others in the publishing industry. So to build out those networks and talk about the big issues of the day that contribute to author experience and the scholarly record. So, yeah, there's really no typical day. It's a very hands-on role. That's what I really enjoy, you know, having those big strategic projects, but also just getting into the weeds of the day-to-day and the operational, what the teams are working on.
Of course. Now, it's interesting because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Emerald, you describe yourselves as a mission-based publisher. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's
so
right.
So I'm familiar. I'm used to hearing that term in the context of, you know, university presses who maybe are not for profits and you know are connected usually with an institution. Would you say the definition is similar in your context, or do you mean something else by that? And kind of how do you at Emerald define being mission based, and how does that impact your policy?
Yeah, so we define mission-based as having a commitment to ethical and equitable publishing practices and promoting research with that real-world impact. So we feel our role is to highlight inequalities, to help promote collective action for change. So to give an example, we launched an impact manifesto in 2022, and this was essentially our rallying cry to all those in the research and publishing sector for change to advance academic culture and incentives and research evaluation. And how we work is we have an impact advisory board, and we have signatories of the manifesto. And together we aim to break down barriers to promote change and encourage this collective action across the research and publishing sector. So we've taken steps towards initiatives such as Real Impact Awards. We signed DORA, and we became a founding signatory of the SDG Publisher Compact, as well as launching impact literacy tools. And then we followed this up with a campaign called Are You In? And that's where we're really just trying to share best practices, encourage wider participation in driving change. And we focus on six commitments in the manifesto. So, as I say, it's things that, you know, challenge the status quo. So we have a focus on alternatives to traditional metrics. We look at those beyond the publication formats and new channels for dissemination. And really, you know, trying to exploit partnerships, you know, create healthy practices for impactful research. So I think at the moment we've had 500 signatories that have pledged their support to the campaign. And we've also got a LinkedIn group where members share examples of initiatives they've implemented. And the first step is as simple as just making a commitment to act. And at Emerald, we don't have all of the answers, and we're also very much on this journey ourselves. But what we try to do is ask provocative questions and challenge the status quo. So we're just one voice, but we really believe that real systemic change can only be achieved by us all working together in the research, education and publishing sectors to come together. So Emerald will keep banging the drum for that to happen, but we just look for opportunities to work really collaboratively across the sector.
Is there something tangible that you could say, okay, by the time that I'm done with my, you know, my stint here and my time, if I could accomplish this or that, that would really be meaningful to you personally?
I mean, it's really interesting because at the moment we're in that the decade of action, and a lot of the research that we publish in Emerald is really aligned to those UN SDGs. And I think we've sort of been blighted by, you know, things that have held us back in this decade of action. So it started in 2020 and it ends in 2030. And we've got a lot to face into as a society to achieve those really ambitious goals. I'd like to feel that we've achieved some way to highlight the wicked problems that we're all facing in the world, to provide resources and support through working with researchers and providing them with a platform to get their research out further than academia. And that might be in a variety of ways through you know, panel conversations, through podcasts, through just really increasing the real world impact of their research in a small way. So I don't really know what good looks like. And I think even when we get to 2030, we'll still be adapting and changing because there'll be new pressures. You know, I think the decade of action has obviously been impacted by things like COVID and now, you know, increasing conflicts such as the war in Ukraine, ecological disasters. I mean, we were all talking last week about, you know, plastics in the ocean. So as a society, we've got a lot of challenges. So if the work that I do with Emerald in a small part can make a difference, but I don't think we'll ever stop. We'll always be adapting and responding to change because change is that constant.
It amazes me that it sounds somewhat intuitive that you had set this as the decade of change and set a priority for expanding the reach of research well beyond the ivory tower or the academic sort of typical, because I think that stereotype was, which is like many stereotypes have an element of truth to them, it really did kind of bear itself out during the pandemic, right? With a lot of skepticism around the scientific process and how we go about, communicating those scientific results in almost in real time, so to speak. And I think that was something that a little bit, may have caught us in the academic world as a whole with our pants down, but maybe in a positive sense, sheds light on, well, what are those things that we need to do in order to ensure that what the high impact research that we're doing really gets broken down, translated, if you will, into language that we can all understand and wrap our heads around.
Yeah, definitely. And it was really interesting when you started hearing, peer review being discussed in news reports as the research was coming through. I don't think I've ever known that to happen, in a typical news broadcast. And it also highlighted the importance of getting content in front of the paywall and, publishers, making a commitment to do that. And then I guess it also highlighted some of the frustrations in the process, the speed to publication. It takes a while, but for good reason, because, it needs to be rigorous and robust. So, you had a real world emergency, and some of the ways of working could be frustrating, but also you want to deliver the right solutions because literally lives depended on it. So it was a very interesting time.
Yeah. And there were things that were, alongside the legitimate frustrations of of slow time, there were things that were published too quickly and had a negative impact as a result. So I think we all learned.
There's a reason why there's that academic rigor.
Correct. And when the pendulum swings too quickly from one side to the other without it being responsible, tested and verified steps, you do run risks of, you know, I don't think your typical journalist would be able to differentiate between a preprint and, a final article. And that doesn't mean that there isn't value to both, but it does mean that we've got work cut out for us to make sure that it's clearly understood and defined and delineated. So let's swing back around to the SDGs for a minute and tell us how the SDGs really impact the publishing industry specifically.
So a lot of publishers, and Emerald's proud to be a founding signatory, have signed the UN SDGs Publisher Compact. So this was launched in 2020. And I think it was a result of a collaboration between the International Publishers Association and the UN. And it's designed to inspire publishers to take worldwide action and accelerate the progress towards those 17 UN SDGs by 2030, that decade of action. And as we've said, it's important now more than ever since COVID, since environmental issues, times of conflict. And for Emerald, it was a real natural step for us being this mission-led publisher. So we had already been committed to promoting equality and mission-based research that supported the UN SDGs. We'd already started talking about having a fairer society, supporting these healthier lives, promoting quality education, mitigating climate crisis. And by signing the compact, Emerald and other publishers are really making a clear commitment to developing sustainable practices and really championing the SDGs, publishing content that will highlight, inform, develop and inspire action in that direction. And at Emerald, we're also seeking to create new measures and definitions for impact that really reflect the modern research era that's increasingly interdisciplinary. So, the nitty-gritty problems that we face as a society, they can't be solved by just one discipline. And it's about bringing people together. And they're framed perfectly by those UN SDGs, whether it's, zero hunger or action on climate change. So, It takes more than one discipline, and it's how publishers can band together to collate, to have this collective action. So publishers commit to things like stating their sustainability policies and targets on their websites. They incorporate the SDGs and the targets into the content that they publish. They raise awareness amongst their staff, suppliers, customers, and stakeholders, and they collaborate with others to advance the progress. And that also includes putting aside necessarily funding, so having budget and other resources to support SDG-focused projects. So there's lots of things that publishers can do with their own suppliers and networks, and also things that they can do together. And that's what we try and do as well with the SDG fellows.
The what's really interesting piece to me is the interdisciplinary piece for a few reasons. First of all, in my work running an author services company, we get a lot of complaints from researchers who are interdisciplinary, who say, I went to the economics journal and they told me that my article was too sociological. And then they go to the sociology journal and they're told that the article is too economics heavy. So I think, and that's not specific to Emerald, but I think there's work for us to do in the publishing industry to make sure we can support and do that. And I think it's especially interesting to me, this is something I've been kind of processing and more recently, is that, I think what happens sometimes, especially as we automate our processes and systems, is we have to categorize and classify, right? We have to, force someone to choose what is your field, right? It's something as simple and basic as that, which is something that, our programmers come to us and say, well, okay, you want to try and personalize and customize, well, we need to categorize and classify. And I think there's a benefit to it because it can really speed up and automate processes that don't need the human input. On the other hand, it can limit and put people into frameworks that are limiting, that don't allow them the full possibility and capabilities of, you know, being able to express something entirely new. So I don't know that there's a, I don't know, have a solution to that issue, but I definitely think it's something that we kind of always need to be thinking about is, are the rubrics that we're setting up helping authors succeed, or are they actually limiting them in certain ways that maybe we didn't even intend?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think increasingly you're seeing launches of interdisciplinary journals ways to rank those journals as well, because, you know, we all want to have a range of different metrics to rank value, but you also need to signpost along traditional metrics so researchers know where to publish. And I think even in journals that have a more narrow field of vision aligned to their subject discipline, there's opportunities to use things like special issues to introduce that interdisciplinary focus. And that's something that we are doing increasingly at Emerald and at other publishers to also, you know, try and tackle the focus of the UN SDGs that just by nature are interdisciplinary. So we want to capture that research and share it with a range of audiences as well through the special issue.
Interesting. I'm curious how, you know, I've always kind of thought about the special issue and there are some scholars that we work with that really kind of focus on that. But I think most, you know, find that maybe it's... First of all, there's a time limitation as opposed to a general journal entry. And secondly, they may or may not have, you know, research ready that can answer that. So I find it to be kind of an interesting form of publishing. Do you find that the response there or the ability to publish there is easier or harder, or, you know, authors have, is that a form that authors have been kind of picking up and responding to positively?
Yeah, they have actually. I mean, you have to have a longer lead time to allow for authors to submit papers, particularly if they're finishing off research. But it's something that's actually really welcome, and we do get a lot of people submitting papers to special issues. So it tends to run between sort of 12 and 18 months to make sure that we can. Get enough submissions to launch the special issue, but it's something that researchers do respond really well to, and it's a really nice way to also introduce guest editors within the journal itself. So it's something that's really well received, and we tend to find that we get a lot of engagement from the thematic nature of special issues.
Got it. Okay, I wanna get to what I think is probably what I'm most excited to speak to you about today, and I applaud you for your being brave in discussing a topic which I think we can all say is none of us are experts about. There's actually something nice about the fact that there's a topic that we're all ignorant. Yeah, exactly. And you had mentioned before, it's really interesting because you had mentioned before that no one had paid attention to peer review until all of a sudden the pandemic hit and everyone's talking about peer review. Well, I can say a similar statement for large language models is that I don't think anyone cared, kind of the back end of maybe how large translation or editing technologies worked as long as it produced good content. And all of a sudden, we have been thrown into the limelight in the language services industry of trying to explain to the world what these kind of big jumps in technology are and how they're based really on the use of human language. So with that as an intro, I'm curious to hear from you about some of the particular challenges or issues that you're facing in Emerald with the release of... Obviously, AI tools in general, but I think specifically GPT has kind of brought a lot of those tools that existed for the last few years to the masses. What are some of the issues that you're contending with, or that maybe some of your fellow publishers are contending with?
Yeah, so I think the specific issues we're contending with at the moment is how we adapt our policies and ways of working that is reflective of the positive benefits of tools such as ChatGPT, while also trying to prevent publication of work that might be plagiarized and isn't based on research conducted by the author or authors. So there's lots of conversation internally at Emerald, and also among colleagues, not just in the publishing function. So I think that's what is really interesting about ChatGPT. It's just really sparked the imagination of everybody, it seems. And internally, the debate has been really driven actually by a colleague in finance who's just really dived in and sort of removed his accountant hat and just said, you know, what are you really worried about this? What, you know, how's it going to affect publishing? So how we're responding just internally for fun at the moment is just is running a range of experiments with ChatGPT with volunteers across the company to discover more and really have that distributed knowledge. You know, it's, you know, how can we understand this new technology and also identify its impacts on our respective functions and publishing as a whole. So that's certainly been happening. And we're proceeding with caution, but we're also sort of remaining positive about the benefits. And then in terms of responding and what other publishers are doing, I think it's just, I think we're all agreed that ChatGPT can't be an author. you know, we cannot consider it to be capable of initiating either an original piece of work without human direction. And then we're sort of relying on, you know, Coates' position on AI tools so that these tools cannot fulfill the role or be listed as an author in an article. I think some publishers have stated that the final decision about the use of these tools to assist with writing a paper may lie with the individual journal editor. And I think we've all stated that transparency is key. So if these tools have been used, you know, there has to be attribution and acknowledgement. And then if they have been used in some way to create the paper, ultimately the responsibility for the integrity of the content generated lies with the author. But it is a great leveler. It changes and evolves every day. I think there's, I don't know how many stories in the newspapers every day. So I think the situation is in a state of flux, and policy decisions will evolve really on the fly as we get to learn more. So Emerald, we are asking authors at submission to confirm that manuscript has been created not using ChatGPT or such a tool. And if a portion of the manuscript has been used, to flag it and do that acknowledgement in methods and acknowledgement at submission. And then we're looking as well as how the submission systems can evolve to really clearly
detect.
Help the author flag and detect. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, I think transparency is the key, because I don't think publishers want to hold back the tide, and there probably are many, you know, there are many benefits to this technology, but I think we just need to ensure that, you know, ethical practices are being followed and its use is being disclosed.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. There's a lot to unpack there, but we'll try to do it slowly, slowly and carefully. I'm curious, first of all, in terms of, I've seen you mentioned the word plagiarism, and I've seen that thrown out a lot.
Yeah.
I wonder kind of where, you know, to what degree the use of GPT, let's say at least for, you know, for finding and sourcing materials, or for even for helping with parts of the writing, you know, to what degree that would fall under the traditional category of plagiarism, in the sense of, you know, do we see plagiarism as taking someone else's work and using it without attribution, or do we see it as passing off work that you did not create as your own? And I think that's before this existed, I think that, you know, distinction was sort of, you know, semantic, only semantic, whereas now I think it's a really important distinction to try and make. I just recently read that plagiarism actually comes from the Latin word to kidnap, which is also interesting. so I don't know what that tells us about plagiarism, but I guess we are kidnapping. So I'm just curious kind of where you fall on that issue of that question.
Yeah, I think originally I probably would have said the former. So, you know, taking someone else's work and passing it off as your own. But now, I guess, did that work even exist, or is it a combination of a number of sources? And I think it's probably an evolving and more sophisticated definition of plagiarism now, because of the ability of these tools to take a lot of data that's out there and combine it and compress it together.
That's the question that I've been asking myself. It's like, well, what do we do as humans? Like, what does our brain do, right? We take the myriad of experiences that we have, the information that we learn, we process it, we sift through it, and then we decide to, you know, make a statement or write a sentence. And it's like GPT, in many ways, in my mind, models that kind of the functions that our brain does, right? None of our ideas are entirely novel in the sense that they don't have a source, right?
Yeah.
So it is interesting, you know, and we create new brainwaves as we create new kind of new neural connectors as we think. And that's an important part of the human development and experience. But GPT is not that different in that sense of, you know, kind of how it works.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people are very confident at the moment they can detect content that's being created by GPT. And I've been playing around, and yes, to an extent you can. There's an element of not superficiality, but it doesn't always feel, it feels like it's feigning knowledge when you read something back. There lacks a depth, but probably not in all cases. And it will get better. It will get smarter. It will be harder to detect.
Yeah.
I mean, it's exciting, a little scary, but exciting as well.
So let's talk about the exciting for a minute, because I think that is important. My feeling, at least in the public eye, and I'm sure it's different behind closed doors, is that, you know, the messaging as a whole, and I'm generalizing here, of the publishing world has been, you know, slam the brakes before we hit the gas. And there's a certain level of responsibility to that. And that makes sense. It even sounds like even within Mammerald, you know, there are the possibilities that you're entertaining internally. And then there's the sort of formal policy until we know better, which makes sense. But I'm kind of curious to hear from you, what are some of those opportunities that you kind of, you know, even in a very initial, you know, kind of just brainstorming and kicking ideas around, what are some of those exciting opportunities that you've seen that can be applications of GPT that are used for good?
Yeah. You know, I think AI tools have always been used by publishers in recent times to, you know, to support the publication process, to, you know, to help correct errors in grammar, spelling, punctuation, house style. We use them to analyze data on user behavior on our platforms and identify engagement, you know, around page views, clicks, time spent on a page. So, you know, that those AI tools have always been supporting that. I think where ChatGPT goes further and is also an open AI tool means there's just a lot more potential uses, not just for publishers, but also for researchers. So, you know, the ability to analyze, you know, large swathes of data, the ability for publishers to help researchers through personalized searches based on their choices on a platform. And then I read a really interesting article, and I think it was Research Information, a colleague from Emerald participated in it, as well as a colleague from Springer, but we're talking about the uses of AI for peer review, and, you know, combating reviewer fatigue and diminishing reviewer pools. So it was suggested that AI tools could support the translation of research articles into the home language of the researcher who's got English as an additional language. They could do their peer review in their own language, and then it could be translated back. And that really, you know, that removes barriers for researchers with English as an additional language, that they can then be part of that review process. And it removes the pressure on reviewer pools and speeds up the time to publication. So that would be an amazing use case for ChatGPT. Yeah. I know we had a call this week with the SDG Compact Fellows, and we were really excited about the natural language capabilities and the creation of lay summaries, again, to get research beyond academia into the hands of an audience, a practitioner or a wider society who'll be able to use it. So there are some really positive benefits, I think. And those are the bits that we get excited about. If it can do the heavy lifting for some of the, you know, the grunt work when you're creating, I guess, guidance, I think there'll always be a human curation element. But if there are ways of speeding up routine processes, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Without getting into the weeds, I will just make a comment in parentheses, which is that I like the idea of the translation for the peer review. I think it could be really positive. I would personally, based on the research that I've done, actually start with the more classic machine translation tools, which are more the writing is not as fluid and is more clunky, more literal, but is more accurate. Whereas, you know, ChatGPT is known to hallucinate, and we've seen this in our internal research as well, is that it can just make shit up. And that's not something we want in order to improve the scientific rigor and process. So I think it's a great idea. But if we're talking about pumping the brakes, I'm not sure I would do that with GPT per se, but I do think with some of the more, you know, advanced neural machine translation models, that could be a really cool, you know, kind of experiment to do and see how it works.
And I think that's the thing. Don't be frightened of the technology. I think that human intervention or that human curation is always going to need to be there. So approach it with excitement and caution, a combination of both.
Yeah. Sally, we've got, you know, I know we had planned an entire section on open access, but I'm also wary of the time, and I appreciate that the time you've already given us so far. But maybe you can just, you know, kind of finish off with a little bit of a reflection now that we've been through, you know, I don't know where you want to pick this as the starting point, but, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of open access. And specifically within the context of our previous, what we've been discussing, which is, you know, the mission and fairness and making sure that researchers really getting out there in a proper way. I think that the founding philosophers or the founding of thinkers about open access really did have that intention. To what extent do you believe that's been delivered and executed on, and what work maybe still needs to be done in order to try and get there?
So I think a lot of progress has happened on open access by a great number of individuals, organizations, and institutions. But yeah, it's clear there's a long way to go. And one of the biggest barriers to overcome is how to remove the paywall without raising barriers to publication for unfunded authors. And that's particularly important in SSH, where you know, authors, researchers aren't supported to open the version of record and don't have the same opportunities as those working in STEM research at the moment. And it's a complex issue, and I think we're far from solving it. So funded authors or those in wealthy institutions who have access to publishing support via things like transformative agreements are in general really well supported. But even where they are supported, I think there's still that complexity, and it can feel overwhelming. So it's very clear also that different countries are taking different approaches, which means it's very difficult to transform a whole program in a sustainable way. So it does mean that we have to just go as fast as our communities will allow or are able. And for us, most of our authors are unfunded. So it's really important that we think as a publisher about the range of options and the ways that we can support our authors and help them on their way to an open journey the best way we can. So it's fluid, and there's still a way to go. But I think we all agree in the principle that you know, the big issues of the day that we've been talking about, and we were talking about COVID and how important it is for research to be in front of the paywall, but also recognizing that in a lot of disciplines, it's still not funded.
Yeah, yeah. Sally, this has been really eye-opening and informative, and I really thank you for taking the time out of what I know is your very busy schedule in order to join me here today. I'm sure that our audience learned a lot from your insights and also, you know, being willing to go on record. I don't know how important this record, particular record is, but on the record talking about the AI tools as well, because I think that's something that is important. I think that authors are going to be turning to publishers, and I totally understand publishers' desire and need to kind of make decision that's based on data and thought and reflection, but also being able to respond in good time, right? That's the balance of, that seems to be the theme, the recurring theme of this decade, right? How do we respond quickly and responsibly, no matter what the advances are? And let's assume we're only in 2023. So like, we've got time, time to go here. We've got 7 years of, who knows what's going to happen. Years. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So thank you so much. And I look forward to continuing this conversation in here or in different fora, and encourage everyone. If anyone does want to, you know, learn more or you know, check you out, or do you have any presence on any of the socials, or do you stay away and prefer
I am on social, so you'll find me on LinkedIn. You'll also find me on Twitter. So please reach out. Always happy to have a conversation and learn different perspectives.
Brilliant. All right. Thanks so much, Sally.
Thank you, Albie.
Bye-bye now.